KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. When Tony McNamara took on the challenge of adapting a 1992 novel into the Yorgos Lanthimos film Poor Things, he found inspiration for Emma Stone's character close to home.
I was saying to Yorgos, you know what? My kids aren't nice. They're sort of narcissistic sociopaths on some level. And I told him the story of being at a restaurant with my son and this screaming baby. And he went, "Someone punch that baby." And I told him, and he started laughing. He goes, "That's it. We should put that in."
McNamara talks about how he and Lanthimos managed to take a book about Scottish nationalism set in Glasgow and turn it into their own Poor Things. Or not so poor things, the film is up for 11 Oscars this weekend, including McNamara's own nomination for Best Adapted Screenplay. And the screenwriter behind the Hulu series The Great, as well as Poor Things and The Favorite, tells us he hears voices in his head. But first we banter. Stick around. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, finally, the Oscar weekend is upon us. I think we are in great suspense about what wins Best Picture. Just kidding. But there are, you know, some very popular films in contention. And I think we have reason to think maybe the Oscar presentation will rate better this year than it was like dying for years. Maybe will it get a little bit better, you think?
Oh, absolutely. I think that, first of all, award shows across the board have been up this season. The Grammys and Globes were both up from previous years. I think the Barbenheimer phenomenon, the number one indicator of whether the Oscars rates well, is whether there are movies people have seen in contention. And this year, the two most talked about movies of the year, Barbie and Oppenheimer, are both in contention in several categories. And Oppenheimer is expected to win a bunch of Oscars. So put the math together. Last year's ceremony drew about 18.8 million viewers on ABC. I think they could be up 10, even 15% this year.
Oh my goodness, people in Hollywood would be overjoyed if that happens.
Still down from the heyday.
Sure.
But that's the right trajectory that the Academy wants when they are headed towards this 2028 end of the current contract on ABC, and they're going to have to negotiate a new one. And the Academy is probably not going to get the $90+ million a year from ABC that it currently gets.
I would say there are various reasons that that will not happen. Yes, I completely agree. Meanwhile, let's look at that parent company of ABC, Disney. Still in the news, Bob Iger spoke this week at a conference. He said there is no Marvel fatigue, that it's a question of the quality of the films, and if you build it, they will come. He says he's killed some projects painfully, all of this in anticipation of the shareholder vote coming up. They have two dissident challengers, mainly Nelson Peltz, backed by embittered former Disney executive Ike Perlmutter. And they cannot sleep on this. You know, they do have to respond. So Bob Iger is doing everything he can to say, "I'm righting the ship here. I've got this."
Yeah, and he tailors these comments not for the investor community, but for these two particular shareholders and all the people that are about to vote on whether to accept them. And that's not an accident. I mean, there's no way Bob Iger would be talking about scrapping Marvel projects even like 4 or 5 years ago, because he didn't want people to know about that if they've secretly developed stuff and then got away. He's projecting the air of, "I got this. I know what I'm doing. I'm back at the helm. I am a creative-driven executive. And if Disney is going to right the ship creatively, I am the guy that needs to be in charge, and you need to listen to my plan and not these other corporate raider types who have no creative experience and are just there to boost their own stocks."
Yeah. So 20 plus years ago, there was a shareholder revolt at Disney led by Roy Disney, who had the advantage of looking so much like Walt Disney, even though he was his nephew. And they got a ton of these mom and pop shareholders to listen to them. They had lost faith in Michael Eisner. And they also got a very influential institutional investor group to come out and support them as dissidents. That hasn't happened yet. I don't think it will. There's time before the shareholder meeting April 3rd. By the time that actually happens, a lot of these votes will be committed already. And instead of having the Disney family on the other side this time, Bob Iger actually has the Disney heirs and grandchildren on his side, including Abigail Disney, who has been very critical of the way Disney treats its workers. She, nonetheless, is backing Bob Iger.
Yeah, and she's somebody who has said, how does Bob Iger sleep at night when his compensation is so far out of whack with the average Disney employee? So that was a definite surprise to see her. You know, the Disney family doesn't always get along, and to see them coalesce here around Iger and basically say that Nelson Peltz would be the worst thing to happen to the company, that I think is significant, because while Disney is owned by a lot of institutional investors, there still are the mom and pops and the people who own it because they love Disney. And those people look at the Walt family and say, okay, well, if they're on board, they're probably going to be on board too. And I think that's what that was designed to do. It was also a timing thing. Disney knew that Trion, Peltz's company, was going to have to file this infamous white paper that they have been teasing for months now, which is laying out their vision for how Disney has lost its way and how it can be brought back. And indeed, that happened this week, where Trion put that out. It is very detailed. It goes into all the supposed problems. It's like a deep dive on things they've already said publicly a million times. But it is, in very stark terms, describing how Disney has underperformed both the general market and peer companies. So if you are an institutional investor, you're looking at this and all you care about is your money and your stock, you say, oh, okay, well, they're not wrong. Disney has underperformed. Maybe these guys, maybe we should give them a shot.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I mean, a lot of companies have underperformed. You know, I think as we're speaking, the Warner Brothers Discovery stock is trading at about $8 a share, which is unbelievable to me. I mean, come on, they have assets. It's not an $8 a share company, but it's in trouble. So Disney is hardly alone, is my point. The Disney children, their descendants, are calling Peltz a wolf in sheep's clothing and a villain in a Disney story. So they have definitely made their opinion clear. Meanwhile, a new wrinkle in Hollywood, there is a lawsuit. It's been brought by this guy, Brian Benneker, who is a script coordinator on the CBS show SEAL Team. He is suing Paramount and CBS, claiming that he did not get opportunities that he should have gotten as a white man because of diversity initiatives. And he has a slew of demands, including that he should be made a producer on the show, which is, he's written like maybe two or three scripts, I think, but this guy was not promoted to writer. And so he is blaming that. But what makes this stand out from a lot of other possible complaints is that this is the arrival of Stephen Miller of the Trump administration on the shores of Hollywood. He has been chasing this kind of anti-diversity stuff all over the place in academia. And now I think he wants to bring it here. I don't know if Brian Benneker found him. I can't imagine how he would have found Brian Benneker, but he is going to try and make a big deal in liberal Hollywood about the treatment of unfortunate white men.
It's easy to dismiss this stuff because I think when you talk about diversity programs, the studios would be like, yes, guilty as charged. We do have a diversity program that seeks to recruit and promote diverse writers because of the terrible history this business has had towards letting diverse writers into the writer's room. And they would probably say, go ahead, challenge us. I mean, this is the exact situation I think Stephen Miller was looking for. It's not a secret. This stuff happens. But the justification has always been that the diverse writers' room is the goal, that these shows are better with diverse writers' room. And that if it means somebody is promoted over somebody else, then that is the creative process for creating the show we want to create. We've seen cases like this be dismissed in California. I don't know how far this one's going to go, but it'll be a good one to watch.
I'm not sure CBS and Paramount want to get into a political battle right now, especially since we have talked many times already on this show about the view that they are going to sell and looking for a deal, and you don't need that added on. So they may
but
settle.
But it won't be the first time Stephen Miller has reared his head in Hollywood. a month or two ago, he led a suit, this group that he leads, sued Disney for illegal discrimination in casting rules. They have a rule that he alleges that mandates 50% of characters must come from underrepresented groups. And that's based on the Disney diversity goals. I don't believe that is a mandate, but he's looking at this. Elon Musk has tweeted about this as well.
Oh, well.
They are looking at this.
In that case. Yeah,
and he is not a big fan of Disney right now because Disney pulled all of its advertising from Twitter/X over the extreme hate speech that was on the platform. And I think that this is only the beginning. There's going to be a lot of challenges. Look, after the George Floyd murder in 2020, a lot of the studios became much more aggressive in their diversity goals. And I think that now you're seeing Iger perhaps like pulling back a little bit from that, but these policies are in place. And I think conservative groups are going to start challenging them because they know that they can get themselves on Fox News and they can rile up their base by doing this.
Yeah. Stephen Miller's America First Legal is a nonprofit foundation, apparently. And I don't know if they want to settle. At a certain point, you know, if this guy, they offer enough money and they're trying to make a political point, they may have a conflict with their own client. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, founding partner of Puck News. BAFTA winner Tony McNamara certainly knows how to sink his teeth into a biting period piece. He created the Hulu series The Great and wrote Yorgos Lanthimos' critically acclaimed film, The Favorite. His most recent work is another Lanthimos project, Poor Things. McNamara tells the Victorian-era story of the hideously scarred Dr. Godwin Baxter, played by Willem Dafoe. In a twist on the Frankenstein story, Baxter reanimates the corpse of a young woman he calls Bella, played by Emma Stone. But Godwin, or God as Bella comes to call him, uses the brain of a baby, which makes for a physically mature adult woman who, at the beginning, has a young child's mind. In a scene where the pair travel by carriage, Bella spots an ice cream cart.
Stop! God, we go!
No, Bella.
Bella want walking ice cream.
No.
Bella wants.
My face. People scared of God. Laugh at God.
God lovely. Like dog face. Woof. Woof, woof.
Quite.
Stop me walking.
More.
No now. No never.
Just no.
Ah! Ah! Oh! Ah! Ah!
It seems that you, years ago, started talking about adapting this book, maybe even before you were making The Favorite, of course, with Yorgos Lanthimos.
Yeah, we were. I've been done a few drafts of The Favorite, and he had told me about the book. And I think, no, at the time, he just made his Greek films. He hadn't made Lobster or... So he was a bit like, I've got this Scottish book I'm kind of obsessed with, but no one will give me any money for it because it's pretty weird. And then... He went, then they made The Lobster and it was like, oh, maybe he could get some money to develop it. And so that was like 2017, I think the year before we shot The Favourite or around that time, he gave me the book and we started from there.
The book with the very long, it's a 1992 Alasdair Gray novel titled Poor Things, episodes from the early life of Archibald McCandless, MD, Scottish public health officer. You shortened that. You got at the point in the project, it was shortened. And I guess I read that Yorgos went to see the author in Scotland at the time. He was something in his 80s, and he just kind of gave him, said, sure, go ahead, make this.
Yeah, I think they just hit it off. He was texting me pictures and going, and he was, you know, Alice was a great artist, and I think they just were sort of clicked. And he went for the weekend, and he came back and texted me and goes, he'll let us do it. And we went from there.
He went to Glasgow, and then after that, you made it not in Glasgow. And I know you've talked about why, but tell our listeners what guided that decision.
Yeah, it was a mix of things. It was, I think we were, because the movie was going to be, there's a lot to take in the first act.
that's one, yes, indeed.
One way of putting it. So I think I was very like, I don't, you know, I think we talked about it. And there's a lot in the book about Scottish nationalism. A lot of the book is about that. That, you might notice, is also not in the movie.
I did notice that, yeah.
I think we felt like we were creating this fantasy world and we had a lot of information about characters and about the setup of who Baxter was and what Bella was and how all that would operate. And the idea the audience then had to get across that it was Glasgow and what that meant, whereas I think we felt like if we set it in London and it's not, it's an idea of London, that was just something that didn't matter and the audience didn't have to think about the fact that it was in that. And also I think in terms of the novel, it is a lot about Scottish nationalism and our movie was not going to be that. And right. So it felt sort of like we were going to sort of pay homage in this slightly kind of insincere way. We're going to sit in Glasgow and do nothing about the fact that the book is about Scottish nationalism. And the movie we were making was about Bella, which is a piece of the novel. And so I think we felt like in a filmmaker terms, in terms of an audience grappling with it, it was sort of like a sort of expedient decision or creative decision on some level.
Yes, that would be there is already a lot, as you say, and then it would be that much more. Like, why are we in Scotland? Would be.
Yeah, a little bit.
I mean, there's not a specific period of the film, but it's kind of 19th century-ish. And I think we're used to the many great English novels from that era. And it's not so much of a thought, we don't have to think too much about why are we in London, right? So not only did Yorgos and then you think of this well before, I imagine, Searchlight was ready to make it. And check me if I'm wrong. Did Searchlight just greenlight this like a normal movie? This was not like any independent production scraping for the money.
No, it was very much post The Favourite's success. Like I'd written a draft before The Favourite and Yorgos had told Emma the story while we were making it and then shared a draft with her and she came on as a producer and Element, the Irish producers. And then because The Favourite was a hit and Emma was totally in and on board producing, it was sort of like, I remember him saying, this is the time. If ever this movie's going to get away, this is the time. We've just had a hit. Emma's in the film. She's totally like a creative force in the film. And Searchlight kind of went with it, They just kind of backed their vision of it, Yorgos and Emma's kind of power and Ed and Andrew.
Coming up after the break, Tony McNamara shares why the voices he hears in his head dictate how he writes a screenplay. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on the Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on the Screen is available now wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business and I'm Kim Masters. With his script for Poor Things, writer Tony McNamara has secured his second Academy Award nomination. The film also marks his second collaboration with director Yorgos Lanthimos and his third partnership with Emma Stone following 2018's The Favourite and the 2021 Disney movie Cruella. Poor Things follows the story of an oddly irresistible reanimated corpse named Bella Baxter, played by Stone. Since the scientist who created her uses a baby's brain, her mind evolves throughout the film from that of a toddler to a sort of grown-up woman discovering her autonomy and the joys of adult fun. In one of the movie's many comically graphic scenes, she finds that she very much enjoys sex with pompous macho man Duncan Wedderburn, played by Mark Ruffalo.
Well, then it will just be you I do furious jumping with.
Furious jumping. I love that.
I'm rested. Let us go again.
Again? Unfortunately, even I have my limits. Men cannot keep coming back for more.
It is a physiological problem? A weakness in men?
Well, perhaps so.
when you read the book, and I haven't had the benefit of reading the book, so you'll have to just tell me. I mean, there's been so much chatter about Emma being undressed and the sex scenes, which make a lot of sense in the context of the film. I don't know, given the Scottish nationalism, how much of that is part of the book?
Well, I think one of the things we did with the book was the book, her story is told by the men through letters and various things. You don't ever get her experience of it and she's not the central character in a way, but that was sort of the central character that really appealed to Yorgos and me once I read it. And so I think that there was elements we invented, but in story terms, there was in the book, she did go and work at the brothel and, you know, there was a different take about how she approached that I kind of made up. So, yeah, there was sex in the book. She does explore that side of herself in the same way. It's like she kind of, as this character, she was sort of like naively going into the world with this adventurous spirit, just like she's discovering food and books and politics and sex and with this kind of like unvarnished sort of no society impact on her. So she was just sort of meeting it as she went. Was our idea of it. And then in the book, it sort of does hit various, you know, she goes on a journey but we invented some and, you know, some of the big tentpole bits kind of held us, you know.
Yeah, she has said that she was very involved as a producer, that she had a lot of input creatively. So did you collaborate on what would be included and what would not be included? I mean, I'll say just before you answer, this was a very gutsy role for someone to take on. You have to have this total commitment to playing this extremely, you know, naive character who then changes and grows as she ages and matures. But clearly, it's asking a lot of an actress. And I don't know whether she was just in there completely or there were things where she was like, I don't know if I can do that.
No, I think it was like, because it had such a process to it in the sense that from the time Emma came on to the time we made the film, it was 3 or 4 years. And there was a whole process of how we would think through everything and, you know, that aspect. But every aspect of the film was sort of, Yorgos is very meticulous and him and Emma are, you know, to me, this is their film. You know, they're the duo who kind of created Bella and, you know, the physicality. So they were, you know, I kind of like can't separate them in this film in a lot of ways, you know, even though he's the director and she's the actor, because they're both producers and she was just involved in every aspect of it, you know, so down to words in rehearsal, just kind of everything. So I think a Yorgos film is very much a team and he and her were like the head of that team. So she was involved in everything, how the physicality of it, how everything would be approached. You know, she was always in those conversations with him the whole time, you know. And I think that's why, you know, it's such an invested, incredible performance because she loved the character and still talks about how she misses the character and felt like it was a freedom she'd kind of hadn't had in a way, or a character without shame and a character who was just adventuring in the world. You know, her spirit is in that character. And you know, and I think because she was sort of the first person to read the script other than Yorgos and I. So it's sort of like she was like ground zero for the project, you know.
But I read, notwithstanding the fact that she was so involved from the beginning, that when you write, you can't necessarily visualize a specific actor in a role.
No, I don't. I mean, I know her tone and I have we have a sensibility that fits each other. No, because it's like, you know, I hear voices, I guess you would say.
Okay.
But good voices, not like go to the store and like take everyone out voices, more like just character talking. So it's more like that. So even though I'll know who's in it, when I come to write, something else happens and I can hear the characters talking and they're sort of in my head and that's what I feel when I write it. Even if I know Emma's going to do it, which sometimes I do. But, you know, they make it their own sort of, no matter what you write in a way.
Well, yes. I know that for an actor, like especially the young male actor in the film business, there was always this thing like, you know, you want to make some independent artistic films, but you also want a franchise. And it seems like as a writer, you also, you've written some very, not independent films because of Searchlight, but art house films, and had this enormous freedom, it seems like, on this movie, which was, I guess, purchased by the favorite's success. But yeah. Then you also did and are doing Cruella.
Yeah, I mean, that was just a sort of lucky thing where Craig Gillespie, who I'd worked with, and Emma were looking for someone and both thought of me, and, you know, we all get on. And so, yeah, I mean, they're different experiences, but all the basics are sort of the same. But, I mean, obviously a big franchise movie is a different animal in lots of ways, but the stuff, what you do in your room when you're writing the script and it's just you and a yellow pad and a whiteboard, it's the same thing, you know. And, you know, a different approach and a different, there's much more to a big franchise movie, and there's many more people invested in a way. Yorgos is very much his own thing and, you know, has a very singular vision, and it's kept very private to us for a long time. Whereas the big studio movie is a bigger thing, but everyone's invested in the same thing. They're all trying to make a good film. So, yeah, but I've been lucky to be able to do both.
So going back to Emma, I read that your own child, your little toddler, inspired some of her lines, one including,
I must go punch that baby.
Which your kid actually said. I don't know how old this child is now, but hopefully, like Bella, maybe some learning has taken place about social norms.
Yes, I believe now he's 8. He's grown out of that phase. I think he was 3 at the time. And I think we'd done a draft of Bella, and she was quite nice. And it struck me, you know, I think at the start of the movie, we imagined her as about 3 or something. And I was saying to Yorgos, you know what? I'm like, my kids aren't nice, you know? They're sort of narcissistic sociopaths on some level. And I told him the story of being at a restaurant with my son and this screaming baby. And he went, someone punch that baby. and I told him, and he started laughing. He goes, that's it, we should put that in. And it actually informed her a bit more. So it was kind of good. But yeah, he's very proud.
Yes, I should think so.
Yeah, well, I'd see the movie for a decade, but he's still very proud.
Yes, you could just show him that one line and that, okay, that was yours, and now you go back to bed or whatever. Well, so this has been an amazing ride for you. I know you're working on Cruella too, right? Is it a bizarre, I mean, I don't know if you can do any of this or had to do any of it simultaneously and switch between projects, or do you just have to do first one thing and then the next?
I sort of always am doing a few things at once, you know, a bit of like even making the show, I was still working on Poor Things and the original Cruella. And so, yeah, I kind of like both. I like writing films because I like collaborating with directors and see what they're going to do. And I like TV because it's sort of show running and it's a bit different, collaborative in a different way. So I kind of am lucky to be able to switch between the two and haven't got tired of either. I've just got tired. So
I can relate to that. But I think that when you're writing, I would think having the focus to stay with the characters in your head would be very difficult if you're jumping from the one to the other.
Yeah, I seem to manage to do it. I do like, I have like, I won't, I'll do like 5:30 to 7:30 or 8. I'll be writing a film. And then if it's a show, I'll go to the show at 8 or 9 and then I'll just be in the show, you know, or be in that thing. And it isn't too hard. I can't do more than 2 things at once, but
yeah,
I can do 2. I quite enjoy both. And it's easy. Once I'm in a story, I'm in a story. And those voices come. What can I do? You know?
Yes. They just tell you, say this and say that. I mean, I think that I would not be able to do this. I cannot write 2 stories at the same time as a journalist, but somehow you have that ability, so you are doing it. And I'm wondering now if there is another, I think you said Yorgos is very private and doesn't want people to share ideas before their time. So I won't ask you to specify, but is there another thing going on with these collaborators?
Yeah, there is. There's a script I've been working on for a few years of a book, American 1970s book. And it's, yeah, and I think it's not this year, next year he'll probably make it, I hope, touch wood. But yeah, we're just still working on that together.
Well, we'll look forward to the next one then, and we certainly enjoyed the last couple. Tony McNamara is the writer of Poor Things. The film is in theaters everywhere now. Thank you for talking to us.
No worries. Thank you very much.
And that's The Business. Joshua Farnham produced and edited today's program with help this week from Sue Margulies, Nick Lamponi, and Katie Gilchrist, who mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW shows on kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.